Quel est le point de départ?
Hello, wrestling fans, and welcome to Shut Up and Wrestle, a wrestling history podcast about good conversations and great stories. I am your host, Brian R. Solomon, and this is episode 113 of Shut Up and Wrestle, in which my guest will be the elusive and mysterious man behind so much great vintage wrestling content available online. I'm talking about the one and only Chris P. Lettuce. We'll be getting to that in a moment. Before we get to that enlightening conversation, I wanted to clue you folks in on a few tidbits for this week. Actually, first of all, I wanted to make mention of the passing of Jackie Crockett. Of course, this occurred a couple of weeks back. Jackie Crockett was one of the members of the Crockett wrestling family that we all know. He was a cameraman for Jim Crockett Promotions starting in the 70s, all the way through the purchase of WCW, the Ted Turner years. And he was actually the last member of the Crockett family to work for the organization because he was there as a cameraman right up until the last Monday Nitro in March of 2001. Jackie Crockett recently passed away. He was an institution in Crockett family and WCW wrestling. He was predeceased, of course, by Jim Crockett Jr., who passed away a few years ago. And he was one of the four children of Big Jim Crockett, the original promoter of Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling. So right now we send our thoughts and prayers and condolences to the family and friends of the one and only Jackie Crockett. And actually, you know, before I continue speaking again on the subject of Jackie Crockett, I just had something I wanted to relate that I think is a story that's been out there. I wouldn't be breaking it, but it's something that was told to me by R-Truth, by Ron Killings. Of course, one of the most beloved figures in pro wrestling today and for the past 20 years. And Ron told me when I interviewed him years ago in WWE, when he was on his first run there, he told me that it was Jackie Crockett who was responsible for getting him into the pro wrestling business. In his young life, Ron Killings had some run-ins with the law. He had kind of a tough go of it. He was in and out of jail in his younger years, and he actually encountered Jackie Crockett at a halfway house. Jackie Crockett had sort of taken pity on him and recognized something in him and helped to get him off the streets and get him involved in the wrestling business, setting him on the course for what would be the rest of his life and the career that would change his life. So I just wanted to share that anecdote, something that was told to me years ago by Ron Killings, by R-Truth, and another feather in the cap of the legacy of Jackie Crockett. Now, moving along, I wanted to give you an update on Irresistible Force, the life and times of Gorilla Monsoon. So a couple of things. One is that we have a release date for the book, a publication date. The book will be out from ECW Press in October of 2025. I apologize for the wait. I did put up a post recently online that I had to have my deadline extended. The manuscript was originally due in May of this year. That is not going to happen. It will be due now at the end of September, so I have the entire summer to devote to the writing of this book and getting it just right. Then there'll be a year of production after that, getting the photography, getting it laid out, getting it prepared for a Christmas 2025 release. So I thank everyone for their patience. As I said, I don't want to rush this. I want to get it right. Irresistible Force will be out, will be available in the fall of 2025. And while I'm talking about books, one other book that I wanted to mention. You know, I get sent a lot of books here in the Shut Up and Wrestle compound, books that are sent to me to look at. And the ones that are really special are the ones that I relay to you and share with you. And I just got one recently that I just got started in, and it's fascinating. It's a book called The Six Pack on the Open Road in Search of WrestleMania. And it's written by Brad Baluchian, who actually was one of the people who have over the years attempted to write a biography of the Iron Sheik. That may be one of his claims to fame. But this is a book that looks at some of the key figures in the WWF of the 1980s, and it's a unique glimpse at what was going on behind the scenes in that company in such a crucial point in its history, as well as some of the key figures in the company at the time, both in the ring and out. So I encourage you to check it out. It's called The Six Pack on the Open Road in Search of WrestleMania, by Brad Baluchian, and I'll be sharing the info to that in the Shut Up and Wrestle Facebook group. Now, let's get to this week's conversation without revealing too much. I'm sure a lot of you know exactly who Chris P. Lettuce is. He is the man who makes it possible for so many of us to check out the vintage wrestling of the past like never before. He's the proprietor of Armstrong Alley on YouTube and other sources of vintage wrestling footage. I was able to get him to agree to come on the show, and we had a great conversation talking all about really the perspective that you get on the wrestling business past and present from being able to view so much footage from over the years in different territories and different time periods. We talk about that. We talk about what modern wrestling could learn from the past. We talk about a lot of the different wrestling video libraries and their statuses. It was a great, great conversation, and I'm going to take you to it right now. Okay, so it's my pleasure this week on Shut Up and Wrestle to welcome someone to the show that I know doesn't do a lot of podcasts, but I know that people listening to a classic wrestling podcast like this one, a wrestling history podcast, probably know him. He is the proprietor of the YouTube channel Armstrong Alley, and he is in general a champion of classic wrestling footage and somebody that, for that reason, is fairly well-known and popular with people who are fans, who are historians, and even people in the industry itself. I'm talking about the man who goes by the moniker of Chris P. Lettuce. Chris, thank you so much for making a rare appearance on Shut Up and Wrestle.
Thanks for inviting me on. That's why my podcast appearances are rare, because people don't invite me on. Secret underground existence that I'm living.
Are people afraid of you? What's the issue?
That could be it. I'm not exactly the most friendly person on Twitter.
Well, I think, honestly, as I was saying at the beginning, anybody that is interested in checking out old wrestling footage and that kind of thing, I mean, you've done great services for those people. So, I mean, I'm grateful. I'm a proud subscriber, and I'm just glad that there's a place now, thanks to YouTube and other things, where people can check this stuff out and have access to it to try to keep the history alive of a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole reason that I started my YouTube channel, which basically started as a place for me to put Southeastern and Continental footage, because the first Southeastern footage I saw, I downloaded off of a torrent site, and then I wanted to see more, and it's like, well, good luck. There really wasn't a whole lot on YouTube, and even there wasn't a whole lot to get off of torrent sites. There was something you really had to go digging and buying DVDs for, and I was like, you know, I'm not sure that's what we should really be doing. That was maybe 10 years ago that I knew, you know, if something is, you can only watch it on DVD, it's not really going to be seen by a lot of people anymore. So I just wanted to kind of get it out there.
No, that's very true. And I'm one of those people who probably 10 years ago or more ordered like a whole stack of Southeastern DVDs. I have them right now within arm's reach, because at the time, like, as you know, as you were saying, it's like a lot of this stuff was very hard to find. And it's weird. It's like we went through this era where, you know, you couldn't watch anything, right? And then you had tape trading and DVDs and things like that. But then once that stuff started to die out, then we kind of went into another phase where you also, once again, you couldn't find anything, or at least, you know, there was things on YouTube here and there. But I feel like in the last few years now, that's really started to change. And it's like, it's unbelievable how much stuff you can find out there.
And actually, it's a weird spot too, though, where like a lot of people have gotten rid of DVDs and their DVD players. So there is some stuff that was on DVD at one point that now it's getting hard to find. Like I'm in that situation right now. There was a series of DVDs that David Bix's band put out called the Beta Classics. That was a conversion of a bunch of beta tapes. And Bix doesn't have them anymore. Something happened to all his collection. And I can't find anybody that has them. So that's, even though we have more footage than ever, it is still a constant battle to try to keep stuff from getting lost, whether off of VHS or even off DVDs.
And that's one of the main reasons. And I mean, I know I'm a lunatic and I don't expect other people to do this, but that's one of the reasons too why I never get rid of anything. Like, you know, I love the opportunity to stream things and all the sites that are out there and even things like Peacock and Wrestling Legends Network and stuff. But I still have a DVD player. I still have a VCR. And I mean, it's because I still want to always have that option. You know what I mean? If there's something that I can't get any other way, like I recently came across a Betamax tape, and I've never owned a Betamax player in my whole life, but I bought that Betamax tape and I had it converted because I'm just fanatical about stuff like that. I never want to get rid of anything. And I always want to feel like if I'm out somewhere and I see something that I want to pick up, or if I'm online and I see something I'd want to buy, I don't want to be going, oh, I have no way to play that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I actually never got into VHS at all. And now I have people that'll like try to offer me their VHS tapes. And I'm like, yeah, I don't want them. Unless you can tell me that you have something specifically that I don't have, I don't want to take VHS tape.
Well, there's also a lot of junk too. It's like,
right. People... That's what I feel like when most people offer me, like, hey, I'll just send them to you. You can come pick them up. And I'm like, oh, if man, you're not telling me what's in them, you mostly know that there's junk, and you're just like, I don't want to take and throw these away. You do it.
Right. Those are just people that are desperate.
That's
to
what
get rid
most
of
my tape offers. That's how I translate them.
Yeah. They just have junk in their basement. They're trying to get rid of. Like I've had that happen with, I also collect vinyl records and I collect 78s. I'm basically a media nutcase, but I've had people who will reach out and say, oh my God, my grandfather had this collection of 78s and you know, you should really check it out. It's amazing and awesome. I had one guy show up to my house. I didn't even invite him. And he just started unloading the stuff. And I was like, please put that back in your trunk. I am not taking that from you. This is garbage.
But I don't understand. Like, if you're that ready to get rid of it and just show up to a stranger's house and unload it, just take it to the dump, man. I promise. Like,
yeah,
in my case, what I'm talking about, no one is going to miss your 1994 VHS copies of WWF Raw. I promise there's no value in the fact that they have your original market commercials. Just throw them away.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's the thing. The stuff like that you could so easily track down online, you know, nobody needs to see it on like a fourth generation VHS copy or something like that. But the Southeastern stuff, and I'm, you know, that sort of was, like you were saying, the beginning of all this,
right,
for you. But everybody knows one of the things about Southeastern is they were so far off the radar for so many years. Like even in the territory era, like they were the guys that didn't even want to have magazine coverage. They didn't want any attention. They just liked being in their little corner of the world and no one knew.
Well,
what was
actually
going on.
The whole logic behind that, and it makes sense when you're a small territory running just Alabama and you don't want other promoters to find out what talent you have to come poach them.
Yeah. No, it made sense in a way. It was like that very protective old school attitude. And, you know, and they also, I think, they didn't like people seeing in the magazines that, you know, if somebody was doing well down there, they would want to take them, like you said.
Right.
Or they didn't want their fans to know what, you know, what was happening in other places. It was a very insulated place. But because of that, now a lot of the footage, at least for a long time, was really hard to get. Like, that's why I picked that up years ago, because I'd really seen almost nothing of it. And there was no other way to get it at that time.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I didn't have a big reach. It really was just a one state territory for most of the 80s, I'd say, from, you know, when it started in late 80 until the end of 85. Towards the end of 85, it was really just Alabama. They didn't start running Knoxville again until end of 85 and early 86. So there's not a lot of people taping it. So your sources for tape trading are pretty limited. There right. may have been one guy that was taping Southeastern. If you weren't trading with him or trading with someone who was trading with him, you weren't going to get the tapes.
Yeah, I think another thing that was funny is when I finally got to watch a lot of it, I think because they were so isolated, I think they would sometimes do things that they knew they could get away with because the fans didn't really know what was going on anywhere else. So they might copy an angle, or even I saw, I forget the person's name, but I'm sure you've come across it. There was a guy that they had who was the most blatant, obvious Dusty Rhodes ripoff I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, Troy T. Tyler.
Like he actually claimed.
Who eventually became Dream Machine. Are you talking about, like the Knoxville era?
Yes. This guy claimed.
Troy T. Tyler.
Yeah, he claimed he was Dusty's cousin or something.
Yeah, he was doing a Dusty stick. That's a future Dream Machine from Memphis.
Oh, I don't think I made that connection. But I remember I'm watching that and I'm going like, there's no way they would have tried this if they felt like anybody watching this would have any clue.
That's why he's the Dream Machine, because they bring him into Memphis under a mask. And so right. they just try to play with the idea that he's Dusty. Although I'm not sure you were ever really supposed to believe that.
Right.
You're supposed to believe that Jimmy Hart's full of crap.
Well, that's also the territory where they would just take some random guy and make him Mil Máscaras or like
Well, let's not, you know, let's not start that argument over again.
the infamous debate, right? Was it,
yeah.
it that's what it was. It was over Mil Máscaras, right? And I think there was somebody else too, where they said, and then there was the Florida thing where it was supposed to be, wasn't there something in Florida where it was supposed to be El Santo? I think it's
well, that was that. That. I think that, well, the only one I know about that is the angle where that was,
yeah.
The assassin came out, was pretending to be El Santo so he could attack Dusty Rhodes.
Right. That's right. That's right. But it was easy. It was easy to get away with that kind of thing too.
Right.
And kind of fool people in the
well,
moment.
Well, that's like, I heard on another podcast recently that like Mr. Wrestling too, if he wasn't feeling it, he would just send one of the prelim guys out with his mask and be like, "Hey, you're me tonight."
That's wild.
How does that
me.
Work? He's a very distinct looking right. guy. He's short and stocky, and he like nobody moves like he does.
No, even the way he moves, I was gonna say, like all the little shimmies and things that he would do. I can't.
Yeah,
imagine.
I'd like to see Randy Barber go out there and do a Wrestling 2 impression. That'd be fun.
Yeah, no, I mean that's a guy that would be really hard to imitate. Like I could think of a lot of more anonymous, you know, mass wrestlers you could take on the personas of than Mr. Wrestling 2. That would be kind of hard to do.
Well, that's one of the things that got me into territory wrestling. You could just see these little low rent, cheap angles that to you, you're looking at, you're like, this is ridiculous. But when you only have one wrestling to compare it to, it's not as bad.
Right, because their audience was educated to accept what they got. That's
right, the worst thing for a wrestling promotion is to have another wrestling promotion to compare it to.
Oh, absolutely.
That's my big takeaway from the territories.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's why there were ones, like you said, that would be really pretty low rent, you know, but people didn't care because that's
right,
what
like,
they had.
Like, if you're in Kansas City territory or Dick the Bruiser territory and you're watching that TV and then Georgia Championship Wrestling comes on, well, that's years before Vince McMahon ever even thought about going national, but you're immediately like, oh, my home territory looks minor league.
Right, and that's why, you know, a lot of times that would happen, that kind of thing. And when Georgia Championship was on TBS, you know, there's that famous story, right, of I think it's like 77, 78, Terry Funk comes home from a tour, he sits down, he's got cable, he sits in his living room, he turns on the TV, and Georgia Championship Wrestling is on his TV in Amarillo, and right. he thinks to himself, like, well, that's it, it's time to sell, you know, obviously.
Right, I mean, we don't have Amarillo TV to compare it to, but we know it was a small territory, so we can pretty well guess that the TV didn't look nearly as good as Georgia, and it didn't have nearly as many stars on it.
And that's what helped Vince, too, when he was doing his thing, because there would be, I mean, you couldn't blame these fans, to be honest. Like, all of a sudden, they're watching this show that, at least from production point of view, and even a lot of cases from talent point of view, is light years beyond the stuff that they've been watching for years. It's like, you know, waking up from, you know, from a dream or something.
Yeah.
So it's easy. You know,
I thought it was an interesting thing about the territories is which ones had fans that were rejecting the idea of Vince coming in and which ones were just like immediately jumped over. And it's crazy to think about. I know he took a lot of the AWA's top stars, but there was like no resistance from the fans in the Twin Cities to the WWF coming in. Not the way that like Mid-South or some of the other territories, like when Vince tried to go to Memphis and he didn't draw, or he went to Louisiana, he didn't draw. He went to AWA and just immediately took it over. I think that's true. Kind of interesting.
It is true. Maybe it's because they took so many of their people that it was like, okay, well, Hogan's here. Mean Gene is here. That was a big one.
Right. I mean, the TV, it kind of like, you took like the biggest parts of AWA TV, like Mean Gene, and then he's now the host of WWF TV. That's like, you didn't have that anywhere else. Like Gordon didn't suddenly show up hosting WWF TV.
And Bobby Heenan, too. That was another key
one. Oh, yeah, Bobby Heenan.
Like, he was their number one heel manager, and now he's over here. So, I don't know, maybe it made it a little easier for them. Like, I know one of the famous stories of the rejections would be, I think a lot of times it would be in territories where there was really intense loyalty to what the wrestling they had. And so I know, like, in Mid-Atlantic, there was a little bit of that, too, because I remember reading that the crowds would just start chanting fake at a lot of the, you know, WWF stuff, because they were used to this more like hard hitting kind of, you know, adult version of wrestling.
Yeah.
And they would just kind of call it, you know, call BS on it, I guess. But I mean, over time, you know, the resistance wears down and he eventually got everywhere. But I think like Memphis was one of the last places, right?
Yeah. Well, I think like Memphis and Portland were able to hold out longer just because it's like, how much effort do I want to put into taking these territories over? There's, you know, outside of Memphis, there wasn't that much to really draw from.
Right.
They don't care Vince, about Evansville.
No. Well, Vince had his goals, definitely. Like, you know, Chicago was important. L.A. was important. There were parts of, you know, Toronto. There were parts of Canada, Detroit. There were things that he had his eye on. St. Louis.
And he quickly realized he didn't want to mess with that Oregon commission anyway.
Right, of course, because then they'd start testing everybody. So there were certain things that just weren't worth the fight. And so, like, he knew, you know, when I worked for WWE, obviously I wasn't there back in the 80s. I was a child. But I knew people that had been there that long when I was working there. I knew people that went back to the expansion period. And they would say, and see, this is something Vince McMahon would never admit, but they would say to me how he was obsessed specifically with the AWA. It was like his number one enemy that he was going after. And he would talk about it all the time, at least behind the scenes. And so I feel like he made absolutely sure that he did as much as he could to make that transition in the Midwest, where those fans over there would accept it, because it was so important to him to get that gigantic, you know, part of the country and all those TV deals out there and everything. That was like his number one goal, I think, was the AWA.
Yeah. I honestly think that one of the big reasons that the AWA didn't have that resistance is, like, I went back and watched some of that early 80s stuff. Some of the things that the AWA did at that time period, really, I think it just turned the fans off. Like when Vern Gagne retired as the champion and then they just handed the title back to Nick Bockwinkel. There was fans on Wrestling Classic still complaining about that 20 years later. But it's not even just that they did it, but you have, if you watch the segment where Wally Carbo explains it, and he's just like, oh, well, a tournament would take way too much time, so we're just going to give the belt back to Nick Bockwinkel. And you can just see Gene Okerlund sitting there beside him, and Gene is trying to just, like, not lose it, because he can tell this segment is, it's off the rails. The big problem is having Wally Carbo as the face of your promotion. I don't think there's a single Wally Carbo announcement in AWA where he came off like a good official figure for the AWA that the fans could get behind and feel like was on their side.
Right. Yeah, he's like the classic example of just like the totally ineffective, completely uncharismatic and just
he can't get a sentence out.
Right. Yeah, they had there was Stanley Blackburn and, well, even Jack Tunney in the WWF was just, you know, would just you'd spend time trying to figure out what they had, like what that guy had on people that they had him on TV doing that.
I don't know. As a kid, Jack Tunney was very official to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. I believed it. I mean, it's weird because back then when you're a kid, it's like you, at least I speak for myself.
Like, I don't think even Wally Carbo could have got like 8-year-old me to be like, this guy is an official representative of the company, an upstanding professional guy.
Right, and I'm watching now some of the Mid-Atlantic stuff from the early 80s where they kind of have Sandy Scott playing that role, and
yeah,
where he's okay, but it's just, it's awkward. You just, I don't know how to describe it. Like,
it does matter. I think, like, we can say this now. It actually, back then and even now, it matters who you have on TV as your authority figure and your face of the promotion. As we saw, WWE put themselves in a position where they beat the heel authority figure into the ground so long that they turned the actual company into a heel for a lot of the fans.
Yes, that's true. And actually, see, I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the things that I love, and, you know, I follow you on Twitter and I recommend people follow you on Twitter, but it's interesting to follow you because for the simple fact that because you've seen all this different footage from so many different places over such a span of time, I really do feel like you have this unique kind of perspective even on wrestling today, because you can judge what works and what doesn't work by things that worked and didn't work in so many other places in so many different time periods. So it's just interesting, because I've always been fighting for that idea that you need to kind of understand the history of it a little bit to kind of get what works and doesn't work and why.
It's true, but it's also like a lot of stuff, it doesn't translate anymore.
Right.
To where you have like, you have a guy and he has a hot run and it's kind of like, okay, well, that's it. There's nothing else for him to do, but now he's got 2 years left on his contract. We can't have him go away. And so you just have a lot of problems in modern wrestling that you can't really fix. Like a lot of wrestlers, like, they're set up to have a 6 to a 9 month run, go away, and then come back. But you can't do that anymore because you have to sign somebody to a minimum 3-year deal. So that's one of those things. I feel like there's certain things about wrestling that it's just fundamentally broken by being a national corporate entity. So you have to try to work around that. And there are just certain things that I don't know how you work around, where you get a guy hot and then it's like you have the right thing set up where this should be a loser leaves, but you can't. Like if Sami Zayn versus Roman Reigns, if he leaves in Montreal, you could bring him back 9 months later and he's just as hot as when he left. And now he's not nearly as hot as what he was then.
Right. Yeah. Because there's nowhere to go. And even if there are places to go, like you said, you tie somebody down to a contract. Now you're just stuck with them, you know, right. The business just wasn't set up that way for the longest time. And now you have this, you know, this phenomenon now, which you never had before, of guys who will spend an entire career just in one company for year after year after year, and they're in front of a national audience. Like, they just, you know, Dolph Ziggler, Nick Nemeth, just showed up in TNA, and the guy had been in the WWE system his entire career from day one. Yeah. And that's a long, long career. And he's the epitome of what they would talk about, of someone that just, yeah, he had all the tools, he had on paper, he had everything that it would take, but he just became as stale as it is possible for any wrestler to become.
Yeah, there is a point where it's just like you can't do another turn, you can't change your look, you can't get a haircut. That's at a certain point when we've seen you for 5 years at a time, there's no repackaging that you can do. You just have to go away.
Yeah, and we know from looking,
I mean, look back at the territories and like how many guys had a 3-year run in one place. Very rare. You might have one or two in each territory that would stay somewhere that long. Outside of Mid-Atlantic, which there's sort of an exception. Lots of guys homesteaded there, but outside also, of that.
Yeah, and in a lot of cases, though, when people would stick around, they usually weren't the big draws. You know,
it either was like the big draw of the one guy, the Dusty Rhodes, the Jerry Lawler, the Bruno San Martino, or the Dominic DiNucci.
Right, or the Baron Mikel Cicluna, who'd be there for 20 years, and he had a decent run, you know, a thousand years ago, and he now he's just the guy in random tag team matches every week on TV, you know, and because they just don't go anywhere. Or Tony Garea, you know, there were people like that, but they usually weren't like the people that had options. That's the thing. You either homesteaded, like you said, a Jerry Lawler, a Dusty Rhodes, because you knew this was the cash cow that you could milk and the people loved you. Or you were somebody who had a lot of options, who was, you know, in demand, a big draw, a big star, and you know you could pretty much go anywhere you wanted to go and make pretty good money. And so they just kind of like traveled from place to place. But other than that, right, the guys that stuck around were the guys that stuck around because they had no other choice, really, or maybe because they just didn't feel like traveling. They just wanted to live in one place, and that was it.
Yeah. You could just get a place that you like. Like some guys would just get to Portland and be like, okay, I'm good here.
Right. Or Florida. That was a big one because who doesn't want to live down there?
Yeah.
You know, Hawaii, I mean, you know, that was like everybody's favorite stopover. Just go there, hang out on the beach for like a month or two and work a few matches while you're there. Less so in a place like, you know, Stampede, for example. Because
yeah.
I'm working on this Gorilla Monsoon book. And it's funny because I'm really going deep into all these results. And what I found, like, for example, like a territory like that.
A lot of guys show up and then leave quickly.
Right, but also it was really, I don't know how to describe it, because it was so far away from everywhere else, and that it was kind of isolated in the sense that you would see people working there. Like if you're looking at the Northeast or the Southeast or the Midwest or something or West Coast, you know, there's wrestlers that...
Wait, no, the weird thing is the most crossover that you're going to see with guys working in Stampede is Puerto Rico.
Yes.
That's where you're going to see the most crossover. It's not going to be the next territory over. It's going to be all the way down in Puerto Rico.
Or there was some Japanese crossover. But, like, you didn't see a lot of people. It was like its own little universe, you know.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of the wrestlers that were there, you didn't really see them moving around a lot. Like
was a little bit of crossover with Portland, but not a lot. Yeah, right. It wasn't like you're going to see these Stampede guys and having runs other places. A lot of them.
No, yeah, not as much as you would think. I saw a little bit of crossover with Vancouver, but not that much. It was kind of
your Ben Bassarabs and your Gama Sings.
Right.
I don't remember seeing them anywhere other than Stampede.
Yeah, they had their little cast of characters, and of course
Jerry Morrow got around a little bit, but
and it's also one of those family based territories where it's like, you know, it's like the Canadian Von Erichs, you know, in a way where it's built around a lot around a family or people that are affiliated with the family or friends of the family or married into the family. And it's very mom and pop in a weird way.
Stampede is an interesting territory to watch. It's very different than basically any other territory.
Well, people
say it's bad.
People say it's the closest thing in the West to like the Japanese style of pro wrestling.
Yeah, I'd say it's not. I mean, you get interviews and angles, but as far as like how much they matter to the show, it's not as much as, not nearly as much as, say, Memphis.
Oh, right. I mean, yeah. It's funny to me. The funny thing about Memphis, and other people have said this too, but like, you know, it was one of the weirdest, most, I don't know what's the word for it, just off the wall kind of territories, but somehow it has this reputation, I think, with people who haven't watched a lot of it, but it has this reputation for being like this real old school territory. And it's really not. It's like they were just out of their minds down there. It was like, and in some ways, like some of the other promoters didn't even really take it seriously. It was almost like a joke in a way. I mean, it's great television, but it wasn't this highly regarded territory at the time.
No, Memphis is interesting. It's one of the more up and down territories that you could just sit out and like, okay, I'm gonna watch a whole year of this. That year could be all over the place, man. Especially like you take like 1985. 1985 Memphis is all over the place. You start off with Randy Savage in January, and then by the middle of the year, you've got Sweet Daddy Siki in and Cyclone Negro, and Tom Ernesto is booking, and his little black book with numbers is very outdated. So he's calling people who are basically in retirement. Like Memphis is one like within 3 weeks, you could have a completely new crew, and like it's crazy to watch like a whole lot of Memphis and just see how much it changes and goes up and down in quality.
Yeah, it could be really erratic. And the good thing about it, though, is for a few reasons that people have talked about, there's so much of it that survives. That's the thing. Like that.
Yeah,
that is one territory, man, where because I even remember.
And even now, there's still people finding WMC versions or where we only had the Louisville or Evansville versions. People are still finding the 90-minute WMCs out there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a lot of reasons for that. It was so highly rated, obviously, in the market there, that you probably had a lot of people that were videotaping it at the time, you know. And I know I remember also there's the story about how Cornette found like a whole bunch of tapes that Jerry Jarrett had, and a lot of that stuff wound up getting out. And
there were some U-Matic tapes. So the U-Matic tape is basically the actual tape they would tape the episode on and send to the stations. There were some of those that got out. I've seen them, and you really do see a big difference in quality.
Yeah, because I'm used to
pneumatic tapes.
I'm used to the tape trading days where, you know,
yeah.
That's how I found Memphis. Like,
well, I mean, that's still how we all have to watch it. You want to watch 1980 Memphis, you're watching whatever we're stuck with now.
Right. I mean,
somebody's third generation dub of Jim Cornette's tape.
Yeah,
you could get Jim Cornette to make new versions of his tapes.
Oh, people, let me tell you, people have been like praying for that. But Jim, as we know, is not the most technologically savvy person.
And I don't see him. I don't see him giving his tapes to anyone else to do that work for him.
No, but he's definitely sitting on some treasures. There's no question about it. There's stuff that I'm sure could be converted at some
right.
point.
Right. At least I'm optimistic that his are in good enough shape to be converted. People keep talking about converting Dave Meltzer's tapes, and I'm like, I've seen his office. I don't think those tapes are any good.
They're probably buried.
Somebody's like, oh, they're out stored outside in the shed, and I'm like, well, good luck.
Yeah.
They ain't go good no more.
Well, you know, oh God, that's true. When I did the Chic book, you know, and then there you're talking about the Detroit territory, which is one that is there's not a lot of at all. It's notorious for how few stuff there is. You could probably watch all of it like in an afternoon.
Yeah, and, that's maybe about 5-6 hours of stuff.
Yeah, and I was in contact with the family at the time, and they claimed, and I don't know if I believed it or not, because Ed Jr. could be, you know, he would say whatever suited him to say in the moment, God bless his soul, but he claimed that a lot that the family was sitting on all kinds of master tapes from big time wrestling in Detroit, and that they just didn't have the means and the resources to convert it because it was too expensive. Now Ed Jr. and his brother Tommy unfortunately have both passed, so I have no idea like if this library exists, if it does exist, who might have it.
A feeling if it existed, they would have sold it to WWE when WWE was paying serious money for that stuff.
I think you're probably right, because WWE was going
there
after...
There was a time when they were giving out serious money for that stuff.
Yeah, I worked
they
there.
They realized there wasn't any money in selling it back to the consumer.
When that was going on, I was working there when they were bringing everything in. When they got Mid-South, they got Florida, they got AWA, they bought Smoky Mountain from Jim and things like that. Obviously ECW and whatever else that they were getting. And yeah, they were all gung-ho about it. I remember, in fact, they made a real strong play to get the Houston library that the NWA wound up getting. And when that deal didn't work out, they actually fired the person in WWE who was responsible for negotiating it. Like that,
I believe I've heard that. I think
that's how important it was.
Yeah.
To them.
Well, I'm kind of glad they didn't get it, because even that very short-lived NWA on-demand streaming service gave us a lot of cool stuff from Houston that I don't think would have gotten to us if WWE had it.
It looks
we might have
beautiful.
Got about 12 matches on DVD before they quit putting out DVD.
Yeah, It looked, I mean, that NWA on demand stuff really looked so good, and they added graphics and things to identify people and information and stuff. But yeah, the weird thing, I mean, like you said, it's true. WWE discovered, unfortunately, that it's a very, very small market. And so I find even, you know, because I used to be a subscriber to WWE, what was it called? The 24/7 thing that they had.
The cable service?
Yeah, they had that on demand.
Yeah, I had that too. That thing was good. Especially like if you wanted to watch pay-per-views but didn't care about following them like up to date, they would put on modern WWE pay-per-views like 3 months afterwards. And that's how I saw like all that stuff at the time.
But for those that don't remember, because it's a long time ago now, it would be this on-demand service where every month they would make different stuff available. So they'd pull certain things, then they'd put on certain things, like, you know, on whatever month it may be. And I'm telling you, there was stuff that you could find on that service.
They
that
put has, out Florida, like full episodes yes. of Florida and
Stampede. Yeah, there's stuff that they've never put on
yeah.
Peacock.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely stuff that they put out there that's not been put out again on even WWE Network.
Now, I know with the Florida stuff, because I was one of those people just wondering why on earth, because a lot of that is really good stuff.
It is, like, they haven't done a lot with it, which
but
I don't know. I mean, I say that it's strange, but it's not strange, because even the views on, let's say, WrestleMania 10, I mean, what are they? And then you say, okay, what are the views going to be on a 1983 episode of Florida Championship Wrestling?
Yeah, it'll be me and like, you know, 10 other people. Yeah, it's true. But I've heard with the Florida stuff that there was some kind of an issue with the family, like a legal issue that maybe they were trying to get the rights back or something, either before Mike Graham died or maybe after. And there's I think it's some kind of a legal issue, because I know
I would imagine I kind of just assume with them it was more like we kept our tapes in the sportatorium where they were taping it is where I think they had the tapes.
Right.
And so it's kind of like how, what was the climate control like on that in a Florida summer? And those tapes probably had some issues with them, which I know is another issue that World Class had, because they were keeping their tapes just, I think, in the sportatorium.
Right.
So some of them had damage.
That's very possible. I remember at the time I was there when they got the Florida library, and a huge reason why they even wanted it was because Dusty was working there at the time and in WWE, and they were trying to do all this Dusty related stuff.
Well, and, yeah, I mean, that stuff was good for DVDs.
Yes. As
like added bonus content for a DVD. But now in the streaming era, it is kind of like they have put out a lot of stuff. I mean, they put out a lot of Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling. And I think the view numbers on those are probably why they haven't kept putting it out, which is unfortunate because I'd like to see more. But I'm also not one of those people that are like going to give them, I can't believe WWE isn't doing this. Why aren't they doing this? They have the numbers and they know how what time it takes to convert one of those and put them up.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I know exactly why they're not doing it. Like you said, I mean, it makes me sad because I know I would eat it.
Now,
up
I want
in
to
like
see
a
it.
Second.
I want to see it, but it's kind of like I get why they're not doing it.
Yeah, and I even have talked to people who, you know, have worked like interns and things who worked there, who their job is digitizing or going through the footage. And yeah, I mean, like I can confirm that it's just not a priority. I think a big one was, you know, there are certain measuring sticks. Like I remember the last time there was any kind of buzz over something archival that they were putting up, it was when they had the last Battle of Atlanta, the Tommy Rich Buzz Sawyer.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, what did they
expect
was going
to happen? It was a big deal online
to
people that
right.
It was a big deal to. But as far as view numbers on WWE Network, it probably wasn't shit.
No, it was important to, you know, people who read The Observer or whatever, and or people like me and you. But it wound up being, I think the idea was it didn't even crack the top 10 for the week in terms of like what the most watched things were. And you know, it was one of those moments where clearly they have to think, like, is it worth the effort to do this? At least from, you know, for a company like that,
right?
To focus on stuff like that. No, it doesn't always make the
because
most sense.
I also know that there's a lot that goes into it. They're not just sticking a DVD in the drive and hitting a button that says convert like I do.
Right.
I mean, that stuff looks a lot, even just the Bill Watts stuff. Even just the Mid-South stuff on the network looks so much better than what you could buy on DVD from the Watts family when they were still selling DVDs. So there's a lot of work that goes into that.
Oh, no question. They're cleaning it up. And it even goes for their own stuff too, their own old stuff. Like, I know for a fact that there are Madison Square Garden shows and things like
Oh
that
yeah.
that
Like
they
yeah, like
have.
it's not just, oh, we screw the territories. We only want people to watch our old stuff. They haven't put a lot of their old stuff up there either.
Right. People have talked about one of the Shea Stadium shows, I think it's the 76 one with Stan Hansen and Bruno Sammartino. It's pretty much a known fact that that was recorded. I've definitely seen bits and pieces of it, and it's never turned up on there. That kind of stuff. Recently, they've been putting a lot of their TV from like 1980, 1981. And every time they put a drop of that stuff on there, I'm the first person that goes to it and watches all of it as fast as I possibly can. But there's only so many of me out there to support those kind of things.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, I wish we had more of it from them, but I can't really complain that much because I completely understand why they don't do it. I know what the views are on my YouTube, and that's free, and anybody in the world can watch it.
Right. So that gives you an idea of, you know,
Right.
that's
What's
the thing.
the views on freaking Peacock? Not good.
Yeah. And especially, I mean, think about that, to go from where it's your own network. Now you're on a network, a
That
platform.
is not at all well designed for
No, it
wrestling
sucks.
content. Where what is season 4 of Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling? What year is that?
Yeah, that's insane to me because I'm sitting there and I'm going, like, I'll go to, let's say, Mid-Atlantic, and like it'll be like season six, season seven, and
Then
I'm
I
thinking, okay,
gotta
well,
start looking up years. I do enough wrestling research. When I want to sit down and watch some wrestling, I don't want to have to do research before I do it. I
yeah,
don't
so
want to have to research what does season 4, episode 16 actually translate to.
it's very counterintuitive. You can't
Yeah,
search. You can't search by the date. You used to be able to even
WWE
search.
Network had a great
Oh
search
yeah,
feature.
you could search for the wrestler, and it would show you who
And you
all
could also
everything.
load the episode up and look at the chapter marks at the bottom and go straight to what you were looking for.
That I miss. You could go like match to match for sure, that kind of thing. And now they're talking about actually all that stuff when Raw goes to Netflix. All of the library stuff from Peacock is also supposedly going to Netflix. So God knows
Yeah.
how that migration will go.
I have a little more faith in Netflix to be able to just, like, the amount of money they're paying for it, to just realize, okay, we should do our WWE setup a little bit different than everything else, and maybe we could just do it by date and not seasons and episode numbers. Because how hard can it really be? It can't be that hard to just design it slightly differently when you go to a portal that takes you to a WWE specific part of the site.
Yeah, they didn't want to make it any different from the rest of their platform. So they have
Right. Well,
all these,
that's
yeah.
just lazy. Like, if you're going to do it, if you're going to spend the insane amount of money that they spent to get WWE content, you might as well make their portion of the Netflix site actually work for their content.
It's
But
also
we'll
why.
see. They might not. Very well might not.
Well, they may decide. My nightmare is somebody over there decides, like, why are we bothering to migrate this crap that nobody even watches? And why even bother? And so why are we going to put, I don't know, 1980 Championship Wrestling on Netflix when no one's going to watch it? I just hope that never happens. And then they just put it back in the vault.
That's possible, but they also like to just talk about how many watch hours they have on the service, and that's a big boost.
That's true. It's like the more content you have out there, you're just boosting your numbers. Even
Right.
if it's 10 people, well, it's
And
10.
it's mostly in a, it has to be in a form that's not going to be difficult for them to upload, at least.
You would imagine, yeah, you would think so.
There's no conversions that's going to have to take place.
No, although now the thing they do now is they censor things. That's the whole other issue
Well,
too,
they already did
right?
that for Peacock, which I don't, I kind of rolled my eyes at all this crying about Peacock censorship. What did they even censor? Like Roddy Piper and blackface? I think we'll all be all right.
We'll be okay.
We're not gonna die. I promise.
People have told me, I mean, I'm not like stringently looking through all of it, but people have told me that there's more. There's other things I don't know off the top of my head, like things that were said or shown or whatever. But you know, wrestling is wrestling. I mean, it's like if you're gonna go that far, then you might as well just not even have the library. Like I like when people say things like, "Well, you know, now that everything's happened with Vince, they're gonna have to like remove him from all the shows." And I'm like, "Are you out of your mind? Are you out of your mind?" Not only
well,
that,
I might as well just be like, "Okay, we're not gonna have any old wrestling on the servers at all."
That's what I was gonna say. If you're gonna go down that road, like, okay, do we also remove anything with Jimmy Snuka on it? I mean, do we find, you know, people that were wrestlers that were in the Ku Klux Klan and remove their matches? Like, how far do you want to go with this? You know, find every, if you go down that road, I mean, it's pro wrestling. All you're going to be left with is watching Bob Backlund matches at a certain point.
I don't think Bulldog Bob Brown has anything against him, which you don't lose that.
All right, that's two. That'd be great. Everybody loves.
Load up Bulldog Bob Brown and watch until your heart is content.
That tells you everything you need to know, too, about the Central States Territory, that, like, that was their guy for, like, the longest time.
It's funny, like, in the Assassin's book, he talks about trying to be the booker there, and he was like, told Bob Gargo he wanted to get rid of Bulldog Bob Brown, and he was like, no, you can't do that. Like, so you got a booker coming in, and you're like, that's his number one thing. You can't get rid of Bulldog Bob Brown. Well, who wants to be your booker now? Nobody.
An institution, obviously. I saw an interview with Vince once from the 80s, and I think it might have been, maybe it was Larry King. It was one of those where he was in the middle of his expansion, and somebody actually asked him, the interviewer like asked him about these other companies that he was accused of putting out of business, and he started bringing up how low rent some of them were and how he was trying to offer, you know, consumers a better product and all that kind of thing. And he made the specific example of Kansas City. He actually he mentioned it directly, the Central States, and how awful their television was and how like poorly lit it was and how they didn't have any stars and the ring was dirty and everything else. Like that was, he specifically singled them out. It was kind of funny.
Well, he was right.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was right.
Brian, have you seen the little bit of surviving footage we have of Central States from the studio? There's like one full episode out there and like a little bit of clips.
Gosh, I don't think I have, actually. No.
I may have put it on YouTube, the whole thing. I may not have. But yeah, it's out there. It's actually pretty good. And I'm like, when I see it, I'm like, why did they ever leave the studio? Because it had to be more expensive to tape outside of the studio, and it looked way better. They actually had lights. The ring didn't look filthy.
Well, because a lot of those TV studio shows, right? I think it was the actual.
It's hard to get studio wrestling wrong. I mean, Billy Corgan did it, but other than that, it's pretty hard to get it wrong.
Well, he got it wrong because he decided to make it into a parody of studio wrestling instead of actually doing studio wrestling.
I knew like by the first week when like we're having fights at the podium and the announcer is getting shoved around, I'm like, oh, he doesn't get it. He doesn't know what studio wrestling is.
Yeah, I mean, I just felt like
he saw some clips of Memphis and like, oh, this is what all studio wrestling is.
Exactly. That was the vibe I was getting to when they started doing things that were so hokey. You could tell that somebody saw some random episode of something and just thought like, hey, let's try and copy that without really getting what you know it was at the core.
I mean, even Austin Idol in 1993 with the Iron Sheik as his top heel managed to do some pretty good studio wrestling.
Well, I think, especially
not that hard.
I think in a lot of cases, those studio shows too, you had the production people and equipment of the TV studio to work with.
That's so, the big benefit that you had.
And that might be why it wound up looking good and looking better quality than stuff that was shot in arenas and stuff, because you had real pros that were doing it. You know, the people that were shooting the news, let's say the local news, were doing your wrestling show. I mean, that's, you know, it's a different kind of animal there. But all I have to go by on the Central State stuff from the time you're talking about is just results and even just from looking at that, I could tell.
Well, the talent wasn't great. I'm like, the talent on that episode, it wasn't great.
Well, no, I was going to say that they you could actually see that they definitely had better days. Like, if you go back far enough,
yeah,
you could see that they're really benefiting from being close to St. Louis and having that connection with St. Louis. But, you know, by the 80s, that was ancient history.
I think even the 70s, it was like, you didn't want to go there. It wasn't a place that you went if you had really good options.
Yeah, it was the only place where Harley Race was a face. I don't know what that says, but... I can't.
He's still a face there, like 84. It's fun. Like, that's the one fun part to me about Central States in 1984 is there's a part where it's like you get all these freaks assembled together, and it's like the alliance to end Harley Race is what I called it. You got Sheik Abdullah and Crazy Luke Graham and Gypsy Joe are all in this stable against Harley Race, and it's like completely ridiculous but fun.
Yeah, and I think when they did the title change, where when he got the belt back from Flair, they did it there, and he was the good guy. Like, they did it where it was like the hometown hero, whereas meanwhile, everywhere else in the country, it's, you know, it's the complete opposite. Oh, Harley Race is the champion again? Oh, my God, no, you know?
Well, when you don't, well, when your other top babyfaces options are Rufus R. Jones and Bulldog Bob Brown, it's fine to have Harley as the top babyface when he comes in very rarely.
Well, that was the thing with those promoters, and Bob Geigel was definitely, you know, the epitome of that. You had those guys that were just, they were set in their ways. They were comfortable. They didn't want to rock the boat or change anything. They didn't care.
You had territories that would age out. That's what happened to Detroit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They just try to keep the same guys. It never really brought in new talent. And it the whole territory just ages out.
And let me tell you something, because when I wrote that book, I was talking to a lot of fans of Detroit wrestling from that time and people that were following it and everything. And, you know, there are people that are passionate about it just like anything else, but they had their good years. They had a few good years, late 60s, early 70s, where it was just on fire and all the biggest stars were going there. But then, and I went deep in that book, and I'm going like week to week in the territory, and it gets to the point where, you know, like my brain is numb because you're just looking at, okay,
same stuff.
It's Lord Athol Leighton. Yeah. It's Mighty Igor. It's the Stomper, Ben Justice.
Yeah, I mean, even like territories that I really like Southeastern and Continental, they had that problem where, like, I love Armstrong versus Fuller's, but there is a point where you've seen it.
Yeah, you're just doing the same thing year after year. You're not looking into elevating anybody else. You're not really looking into bringing people in anymore who are hot. You just have your little thing that's going, and that's it. And this, you know, people just give up after a while. You can't just give them the same thing forever.
Right. I mean, like, that's one of those things about wrestling that hasn't changed. I think WWE got in a spot where they just kept relying on the same people so long that it got stale. But they didn't have to. They're too big to fail, unlike Detroit was.
Yeah, they really are too big to fail. But I think, like, when you look at them now, you can see how much they're benefiting from.
Oh, yeah, they're definitely, like, they're way in a completely different place than they were 5 years ago or whatever, where people are like, we've seen all this before.
Yeah, there was that period. It just, and I'm glad we're finally getting out of it, but of just such stagnancy for so long where, you know, if you look at, you know, the WWF, let's say, between from 1985 to 1990, it's a completely different company. So much is different. The talent's so different.
Well, and people talk about looking at old Royal Rumbles and seeing how much talent changes, and then you get to, like, 2010.
Yes.
2015, you're seeing 20 of the same guys in the 30-man Royal Rumble.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, the teens, whatever, you know, the last decade was the worst time for that. It really was. You could look at the only thing that changed was the pandemic, you know, and the fact that they didn't have live crowds. But you could look at a WWF show, or I'm sorry, WWE show from like 2011 and look at one in, you know, 2018, and there's not dramatic differences there. You know, it's a lot of the same people you're seeing. The production hasn't really changed in any appreciable ways, especially after they went to HD. And now it feels like now, for the first time in a long time, it feels very dynamic. They actually have a lot of choices and possibilities of matches and main events and stars. There's just a lot happening that it really does feel like a change, you know?
That's when wrestling feels fresh and new. That's when you actually have a chance to make it hot. It doesn't matter how good the shows are if there's nothing that feels fresh about it.
Yeah,
and we've seen periods of wrestling where it was good, but it wasn't hot because there wasn't anything that felt new.
Right, and it's easy to gang up on AEW, but, you know, because everybody does it. It's easy sometimes, and, you know, I hate to do it, but that's what they're struggling with now is those doldrums where, like, the honeymoon period's over, and now it just feels like a lot of the same. Nothing really stands out. You look at some of these shows and you go like, well, didn't they already do these matches or variations of these matches? And, you know, they're experiencing that now.
Yeah, I don't know what AEW should do because they're kind of in a spot where it's settled down and they are definitively the number two promotion. We've kind of lost this hope that, oh, they're going to overtake Raw. They're going to beat Raw. They're gonna be the number one. There was this period where we all were, well, not we all, but some people decided they were going to allow themselves to believe that. And now
obviously not
we've
you.
Kind of
you
come
were
back
not.
down to reality.
Yeah.
And we're like, okay, this is the number two. It's a clear number two. There's a big gap. And AEW just has to do something to just set themselves apart a little bit differently. I don't know. It doesn't feel like anything there is hot right now. Like they have stuff that's good that people like, but what's hot right now that's going to, when you advertise it, it's going to pop the rating.
Oh, there's nothing like that. I mean, like, you know, when I think of what's hot, like, for example, I think Swerve Strickland is probably the number one example of somebody who actually seems to have benefited from going there from WWE.
Yeah.
But he's not something that's going to make a difference in the big picture, like you're saying. You know, Punk was. They blew that. I mean, for reasons that you can debate forever whether it was the right thing to do or not. But from a business point of view, that was an opportunity that they no longer have. And I don't know. I'm trying to think of what their turning point was, either that or when Cody left, because that was a big one of how they just basically brought him in as the exact same character that he was. You know, like seamlessly. I have to imagine that was not, let's just say, not good for morale over there.
Yeah. I don't know.
And it sends a message.
They're not
too.
In any danger of going away. They're not
no,
going
no,
out of business.
They're not. They have a limitless supply of capital. That's not.
And they can always bring in new talent, but I don't know. I think that's also part of the problem with AEW is that they just keep adding too many people. And it's just like, do you have to keep somebody on TV consistently on a weekly basis to make them over? And you just bring a guy in, he has a cool match. And then you see him again 3 weeks later. What are you doing? You're not getting him over. It's having cool stuff on TV.
Right. The whole dream match. It's the whole dream match thing that everybody points out. It's like, well, you know, how often can you do that if you're just throwing these two guys into a match cold? And look, I'm not sitting here saying, because I think some people make the opposite mistake, which if you watch enough classic wrestling, you understand that not every single match on every single show needs to have a story or a reason for being. You don't want to.
No, but if you're going to tell me something's a dream match, could you give me a reason to believe that other than just tell me, hey, this guy has good matches in another company that I may not have ever watched. I may not have ever seen this guy before.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That's the other side of it. Like, you don't want to go down the Vince Russo route where every single wrestler needs to have some crazy angle that he's involved in. But if you are delivering a big, important match that people are supposed to really be invested in, then yes, there has to be a reason for that match happening other than just, hey, wouldn't it be cool if these two guys had a match? You know, there's got to be more than that. And it is frustrating because sometimes I will look at a match that they have planned and I'll go, oh man, like that's a waste to me, because that really does look like it could be a great match or a great program between those guys if they built it the right way. And now they're
is like you're getting into a generational divide of what I would consider a good match or someone like, or what you would consider a dream match or a match you really want to see.
True.
It's that it has something attached to it. These guys have had some type of feud or some type of issue, and now they're going to have a match. That's the dream match. It's not just seeing these two guys in a match. It's having them have some type of issue that culminates in the match.
Yes.
And that's, there's other people now that the spreadsheet culture is like, I don't care about any of that. Just give me the match.
Yeah.
Give me the stars.
It comes from the star rating thing. It comes from, you know, the Observer stuff. And look, I'm a defender of Dave Meltzer. I've been an observer reader for decades. I feel like he does play an important function in the business, and he is important, but you also have many, many, many people who I think have come away with the wrong idea. Well, I don't want to say wrong, because I'm just saying, well, my way is the only way.
No, there are people that have come along with the wrong idea that the only good wrestling is what Dave Meltzer would rate as good wrestling.
Right.
And I think that is wrong.
That's the problem, right? When you have one, that's why when people try to say, well, I don't think that there should be a Dave Meltzer or an Observer. And I'll say, well, the problem isn't that there's a Dave Meltzer. The problem is that there aren't 10 Dave Meltzers. There needs to be a lot of people with diverse views of what is good and what's not good. Because otherwise, yes, then you wind up with one person's opinion becoming like the gospel. And then when it exists that way for long enough, now you have generations of even wrestlers or creative
where
people.
It feels like 70% of matches you can watch today, everybody is trying to work towards Dave Meltzer's checklist of what good wrestling is.
Yes, and none of it, you know, after a while, it just all kind of blends together. That's why
I want to just say one thing, and then I don't want to get off on a tangent on Dave, but I just want to say this about Dave. You look at the guys that Dave always talked trash about in the Observer: Dusty Rhodes, Jimmy Valiant, Junkyard Dog. Those are three guys that any wrestler who wants to make money in wrestling should want to emulate more than the Dynamite Kid.
Mm-hmm.
So Dave Meltzer can have this idea of what makes wrestling great, but it doesn't argue with the audience that paid all that money to see those wrestlers that Dave Meltzer didn't like. So he has his opinion, and that's fine. And sometimes I agree with it and sometimes I don't. But he's not like the arbiter of what is and isn't good.
Right. And yeah, and I agree with that. And I think that's the mistake that people make when you're taking an opinion as being, you know, this is the only way, or this is a fact. These people are bad and these people are good. And I think it comes down to also whether you're looking at it as a business or purely as just some kind of performance. And then you could say, well, I like the way this person performs better than the way this person performs. But that's a very inside kind of a view, which is fine to have. But when that view becomes disseminated among everyday fans, then it's kind of weird, because it's like, that's not really what this is or what it ever was meant to be. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's like people who think like you should book the champion should be the guy who has the best matches.
No.
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 When did that ever happen? When was that the standard?
Well, I think I know when it started. That started in the era of...
No, I'm just saying, like, if you look back at wrestling historically and say, okay, this is how this is supposed to work, show me where that was. Show me where on the calendar, where was this happening? Where was this standard?
Well, you
could... Fez, maybe? Maybe that's it.
Yeah, maybe Fez. But you know what? You could see that change in the 90s, though, don't you think? Where all of a sudden, your WWF champion is the guy who may arguably be the best worker in the company, whether you're talking about Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels. I'm talking about Bret Hart. But I mean, you could never really say that before. And I'm not talking about scientific wrestler or whatever, because even when Backlund was champion, yes, he had his scientific style, but he absolutely was not the best worker in the company. Right. I think with that 90s period, you started seeing guys who, because look, you had wrestlers like a Dean Malenko or Benoit or Guerrero and people that in earlier periods, their job would usually be to put everybody over because they were so good that, right. that they could make everybody look good. But then everything started to change where the guys who actually were the best quote unquote workers to the boys became the guys that were getting the pushes. But that was really not usually the case before that.
Yeah.
They would usually be, you know, what they used to call the journeyman. Or
I think that's also a difference between when the company is the draw and the wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that when you need to draw every week. I'm sorry, Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels, neither one of those guys could have been the territory ace where you had to sell tickets every single week. I don't think it would have worked.
Right. And they also, for this isn't a knock on
and
them,
I love Bret Hart.
I do too. But the business also did kind of dropped when they were trying to do that. It wasn't as hot as it was before, and it wasn't as hot as it would get after when they stopped doing that. So, yeah, I mean, there's something to be said for that. The attitude always has been, and from what I understand, the attitude is going back to that in WWE from people that I know on the inside, of the attitude being that, you know, look what they're doing. They're bringing in now, they're trying to bring in all these like college athletes and people that are not necessarily people that get wrestling or know how to work all that great, but they're very athletic, but they're going to need really good workers to put those people over. You know what I mean?
Right. Here's the thing. I don't hate that strategy because you look back at wrestling's past, and a lot of people that got into wrestling and had success in wrestling came from football. Wahoo McDaniel, Ernie Ladd. I mean, I don't know how much these guys were fans as kids, or somebody just was like, hey, you can come make money in this or during the football offseason. So I don't think you have to be a lifelong fan of wrestling as long as you have the right attitude. You know, like I've seen some of those people in NXT that they got off of those deals, and they look pretty good.
Oh, no, I actually agree with that approach. I'm not saying that it's something they shouldn't do. I think, if anything, that's probably pretty smart because your number one goal.
And the people act like, well, this is not what wrestling is. It always operated that way because there wasn't like this. You didn't want to go get the wrestler that was on the outlaw scene. Anyway, there was a proto-independent scene back then, but you didn't want to go pick those guys because they weren't any good.
Right. So if anything, it's almost like the business kind of correcting itself in this,
right.
in this weird
I
way.
I don't think like you have to be this idea that you have to have loved wrestling your entire life to be any good at it or to deserve a spot. It's ridiculous.
No, I've never agreed with that. The idea of paying dues is one of the biggest nonsense concepts that there is. You know, you reward people if they draw money, if they're good at what they do. But this idea that somebody didn't pay their dues, all that Goldberg didn't pay his dues, like, who cares? You know, the person's drawing money. Who cares about dues? I mean, like, at least that's the way I
feel. That, like, oh, this wrestler worked all year round, and now they don't have a spot on WrestleMania because this celebrity is coming in. Well, no shit.
And right, and I think this attitude.
Okay,
this attitude they've cultivated about how you have to have a passion for this and that and the other thing. I really think, in a way, it's really
this weird, like, WWE narrative is taking over for the fans. Like, that's a WWE narrative.
It's very cynical.
That's the thing that they said on DVDs and documentaries and Tough Enough.
Right.
To make you think that you should just eat whatever shit they feed you as a wrestler.
But now it's actually become internalized, so you have young wrestlers who really believe it, and it's weird. It's like they found a way to work their own talent because they'll give you everything if they believe that, and they won't look out for themselves or their own needs. Whereas the mentality always was that you never lose sight that it's a business, and it's not that you should hate it or not care about it, but it's a business, and it's not something that you want to work. You don't want to work yourself, you know, over it.
Yeah. And there's a weird shift in wrestling fans, like, to where it's like, now we're fans of the company.
Yes.
They weren't fans of Mid-South Wrestling. They were fans of Junkyard Dog and Jim Duggan and Rock and Roll Express. They weren't cheering for the AWA. They were cheering for the Crusher. And, I mean, it's like, it's very strange.
Well, it's all about the branding. I mean, I think that started with the WWF, and now it's gone across the board where branding is so important. Like, even if you look, because I've been looking at a lot of old WWF stuff, They don't even really refer to themselves that way as a brand until
Memphis didn't even have, like, people always try to put this company name on it. They weren't CWA until way late.
Not only
they
that,
were
but
Championship Wrestling.
but
We didn't have
sometimes
a promotion name or letters, three letters.
Right, and sometimes even when they would have the letters would just be, they wouldn't be very prominent. It would just be like this fictional governing body that you created to make your product
right, like
look legitimate.
The CWA on the CWA world title wasn't supposed to be the name of the Memphis promotion. It was just this made-up thing.
Right.
So they could pretend there was this bigger governing body and not just Jerry Jarrett decided to make a world title.
Right, and that's also how the WWWF was treated in the early years, where you would, if you bought a program or if you were watching the shows or whatever, the company, the corporate entity, would always be named as Capital Wrestling. It would always say that in the programs and things, and they would refer to the shows as, you know, Welcome to Championship Wrestling, or another edition of All Star Wrestling here at Madison Square Garden, you know, and then they might say, featuring matches sanctioned by the Worldwide Wrestling Federation. It was just this little thing they would slip in to make it seem legit. And it was Vince Jr. who came along and really, really honed in on that. You hear him on those broadcasts where he's constantly saying, here in the World Wrestling Federation, and this person has come back to the World Wrestling Federation, even before he owns the company, because he's very intent on that idea of branding, which has now become the standard in the industry.
Brian, can I put you on the spot and ask you a question?
You sure can.
Do you think that Vince McMahon killed the territories?
Well, boy, that's a loaded question.
It is. I will admit, at the front of it, it's an extremely loaded question.
I think
we don't have to just say, it doesn't even have to be a yes or no. We can just obviously admit right off the bat, he contributed to it. Let's just say, was Vince McMahon the major contributing factor to the death of the territories?
I think he was a very major contributing factor, but I also subscribe to that theory that if he didn't do it, somebody was going to do it, or at least try to do it. But I think what he did, okay, here's my complicated answer. What he did was he sped up a process that was already happening.
I think that's a very fair take.
From the second cable TV was taking off, and then when you started seeing local television starting to die and syndication and things, it was going to happen. And I think if anything, and this is the opinion that gets people ready to kill me, I guess, if anything, in a way, he almost kind of saved
wrestling.
The business, right?
Yes.
He saved it. I mean, yes, he saved it by benefiting himself and
his
own
company.
Okay,
because let's do the thought exercise, and let's say somebody else wins. Let's say Vern Gagne wins. Does the AWA last until 2024?
No, no way.
No. Does Bill Watts stay interested in wrestling long enough that he keeps Mid-South going or UWF going all this time? No, because he got burned out anyway.
Right, you needed a
so,
psycho
like there
like
wasn't
Vince.
Anybody else that could have won and kept it going until now. Like you said, I think it was inevitability. Cable was going to kill wrestling. The more you watch of like 1983 wrestling, the more you'll get the gist that this wasn't just Vince had this idea.
It was ripe to happen.
There was multiple people that were looking at Cable and thinking, oh, we could do a whole lot more with this.
Yeah.
Joe Blanchard was doing it in Southwest. There was this weird thing going on with Ann Gunkel trying to get Global started, and she was working with Florida and Southwest. So there was definitely some stuff going on with other people besides just Vince, and even just Ole Anderson looking at Cable and thinking, oh, we could do something with this.
He was the one who actually succeeded at it, who
right.
didn't spread himself too thin, who didn't collapse under
and
his own
weight.
And
he had the advantage of having the New York market.
Right. He had that base, and people have said that, and it's true. I mean, he started, like they say, he started ahead. Right. He started on third base. You know, like he had the hottest territory. They were already on fire, and they had all the big metropolitan markets in the Northeast. So, yeah, I mean, like, I don't know if Vince McMahon was – if he was the son of Don Owen. Like, I don't know if it would have happened, you know, with all of
well,
his
I
vision.
Mean, like, but just – I mean, there's no scenario where there's still a vibrant full territory scene in 1990. even if Vince McMahon never leaves the Carolinas.
Right. I think it was either going to just disappear completely and just become an oddity, or some other people would have tried it and maybe not been as successful. I think you could have had a scenario where you had a handful of national or close to national companies, which were not really anywhere near as hot as the WWF was.
I'm sure Turner still has something going, whether he owns it or not, but I'm sure he would have wrestling on it.
Yeah. Yeah. There would be something, but it would be a little more underground, I think.
Right.
But
I don't think nobody else could have got to where they have a publicly traded company that they sell for stupid amounts of money.
No, he took a company that he bought for $1.7 million and he sold it for $9 billion. I mean, that's beyond all comprehension, obviously. Yeah, well, look, I could talk about this stuff forever, and you asked me the most triggering question that could get me talking for like an hour, but I do realize we've already been talking for over an hour, but this has been great. This has been fantastic. This is exactly the kind of stuff that I love to talk about, but for people that are listening, before we do stop, how could they, what's the best way that they could seek you out, and if they're interested in seeing this stuff that we've been talking about?
Well, I have a YouTube channel. It's Armstrong Alley, which it would be spelled like you would think. You can go there and find a lot of Continental and Southeastern. You can check out the playlist, because I have everything in order, so you don't have to try to piece it together yourself. There's also a lot of weird wrestling from all over the place, which is what I've been doing lately. I've been hooked up with one of the like original tape traders and trying to get some of his stuff that's never been converted off of VHS and get that converted, because if it's still on VHS now, there's a pretty good chance of it getting lost.
Yes.
So that's what I'm working on. That's kind of expensive. So that's why I have my Patreon set up, which is patreon.com/crispylettuce. That's K-R-I-S-P lettuce. I shouldn't have to tell you how to spell lettuce. That's where you can sign up and help me help fund my ongoing efforts to get wrestling off of VHS. And also, that will get you access to my Google Drive, which is where I'm now putting everything that I get converted instead of YouTube, because I cannot monetize YouTube. And to continue spending over $1,000 a year on wrestling footage without being able to monetize it is just not possible for me. So if you want to help me keep doing that, and also you get access to all the footage, you can sign up at my Patreon.
And I strongly encourage people to do it. I'm a supporter. I think you're doing the Lord's work. You're doing a great service to a lot of fans. And I know that people that do join, sign up, you're in great company. I'll just put it that way. In the wrestling business, and it's just a great, great thing to have out there. So I thank you for putting the work into it. It's phenomenal, and I thank you for doing the show this week.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
There you have it, folks. My conversation with Chris P. Lettuce. And I do encourage you to follow Chris on Twitter. Chris P. Lettuce, exactly as we spelled it on the show, with a capital K. Check it out, and you can learn all about the footage that he has to offer and how you can get a chance to see it. It is well worth it, trust me. Now, thanks for checking out the show. Please do continue to check out the show. Next week, it's going to be WrestleMania week, and I've got something special for you guys. I've mentioned it before. It is a round table of former WWE employees. We're going to be talking about the corporate culture, life on the road, what it was like being a rank-and-file employee of that company in the shadow of really everything about WWE. So in light of a lot of things that have come to light in recent weeks, the Vince McMahon stuff and otherwise, we provided kind of a unique insight into that company at a certain point in time. I think you're going to like it. The roundtable includes former head of security Jimmy Noonan, as well as Deborah Jazway of the Creative Services Department. You may remember Deb from a couple of years back as a guest on the show. And Louis D., a.k.a. Lou DiPietro, formerly of WWE.com, a road editor for the website. got the four of us together, and it really was something special. Can't wait to share it with you for next week's show. Other guests on the way in future weeks to Shut Up and Wrestle. I hope you will continue to listen. We'll have wrestling journalist and writer and podcaster Dominic D'Angelo, as well as PWI contributor and wrestling red carpet denizen extraordinaire Candace Cordelia, as well as my friends from the Whip podcast, the Wrestling Heroes and Insider podcast. They are known as the Whip Dog and Mr. Joe Walker, and they will be here for a barn burner of an episode. Keep listening to this show. And how can you listen? We've got our website, suawpod.com, as well as anywhere you find your podcasts. Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Podcast Addict, Spotify, you name it. Also, be sure to join the Facebook group, Shut Up and Wrestle with Brian R. Solomon. That's where I post all of the additional content related to this show. It's also where, if you were there recently, you saw that I started talking about a project I've been thinking about doing, creating a series of DVD commentaries almost to go along with classic wrestling shows of the past, which I would offer for a small fee on my Patreon page if I feel that there is enough interest, something that could be in the works, something I've been thinking about, and I'll talk more about it in the weeks to come. Also, if you'd like to make a small financial contribution to Shut Up and Wrestle, which is a free podcast, you may do so at my Twitter page. You can contribute on the little money button at the top. Brian R. Solomon is the account. And if you want to go contribute there via Cash App or Venmo, you may. If you'd prefer to contribute through PayPal, you can reach me at brianrsolomon@yahoo.com. You can also get me at that email address, brianrsolomon@yahoo.com, if you'd be interested in buying a signed copy of any of my books, including Blood and Fire, the unbelievable real-life story of wrestling's original Sheik, or Superheroes, the history of a pop culture phenomenon from Ant-Man to Zorro. Some of the other projects that I work on, the wrestling news from Arcadian Vanguard. I am the news editor, very proud to do so. And you can get it every morning at thewrestlingnews.com. Subscribe to it. You could also check it out at the YouTube page for Arcadian Vanguard. So please do that. The magazines that I write for, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, you can get at pwi-online.com. Inside the Ropes magazine, you can get it insidetheropesmagazine.com. If you're looking for me on social media, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Brian R. Solomon. And on Facebook, you can find my author page, Brian Solomon Writer. And on any of those platforms, you will find the link to my author website on the World Wide Web. Shut Up and Wrestle is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And as always, this has been Brian R. Solomon asking you to keep those cards and letters coming in and reminding you that only you can prevent forest fires. So long, wrestling fans.